The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello everyone, my name is Jim Smith and welcome to Recovery Today. Well, this week my guest is Margaret Dane. She's an old friend in recovery and she's had a fascinating life. So I'd like to, well, I'll let her introduce herself, I think, Mark. Yeah.
Margaret Dane of I've Had a Fascinating Life.
That's it. Right. You're transatlantic. Yeah, you were born in America, weren't you?
Yes. I'm born American, American citizen. Yeah. And last year, actually, I became a British citizen.
Did you?
Yeah, God save the Queen. So I'm okay. You know, as we were speaking earlier, yeah. I'm protesting on both sides of the Atlantic.
Yes.
With various different things that are going on. So, yes.
Yes. And this is quite interesting, listeners, because a few years ago I saw Margie in London and she recommended that I watch a program called Family Guy. And that was it. The first one did the damage with me. Yeah. I was a compulsive viewer of that program for a long time. I still watch it occasionally, but it's quite an interesting connection with mm-hmm, Family Guy, mm-hmm. isn't it? Do you want to talk about that?
Well, Margie? Yeah. Seth MacFarlane went to Rhode Island School of Design, yeah. which is one of the best art schools in the United States. And observed that the people in that area, all of his characters in Family Guy are based on the people there.
Yeah.
And being from Woonsocket, Rhode Island, I also lived in Pawtucket and those kinds of places, that's where Family Guy, where they actually live. Actually people in the series, which is an animated series, but they're real people, and I know some of them.
Yeah.
So, but my family dynamics. So, if you ever want, if you ever wanted to, you know, find out what my pathos really is, is watch a couple of episodes of that because that's exactly what my family was, and that's why that show was like that because the people there are like that.
Sure.
You know, they are like that, and it's like. That was me. I'm Meg, you know, so that explains everything.
So what about your dad? I mean, he surely he was
completely like Peter Griffin. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Again, explaining my pathos.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, yes, it was exactly like that. Wow. My, it's just the way they talk. They just blurt out anything that comes into their head and they do it. It's not in, it's not a malicious kind of ignorance. It's just kind of, that's the way it is.
That's
what we think. That's what it is. This is what I'm saying. Not unlike the show, which was kind of built on that. It was like All in the Family back in the 70s was the same kind of thing where, you know, you just blurt out what you think. And it's not malicious. It's nobody is intentionally hurting anybody, but they, you look at it and you go, oh my God, it's so un-PC.
What did your parents do?
My dad was, he worked in, he had his own radio stereo TV store. He was a small plane pilot, which we were flying around in these little canvas covered kites kind of planes, Piper Cubs and that kind of thing, most relevant. My mom basically worked in a hospital in housekeeping, you know, just regular working people.
Yeah.
Again, like Family Guy, just regular working people.
And you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters, older, and one younger brother. They're all in the States, still in the States.
Yeah. So when did you, when did you come over here? Or?
I came over here, I got married a Brit, came over here, went back and forth a few times from Miami. From Miami, I moved from Family Guy territory down to Miami as pretty much when I was old enough to drive a car because I could not stand the winters anymore up there. The blizzard of 78 did it for me and that was it. Sure. I was like, that's it. I could drive down to Miami and live there. You know, and it's like, so I did.
Yeah.
And so I met a Brit there and away we came.
Okay, Marge. So what, you know, around, because I know you had a, like a lot of other people, you know, you had quite a serious problem with alcohol. When do you want to say a few words or summarize the whole thing, really?
My drinking career was not really long. I mean, during the late 60s and that kind of thing, I think you were required as an American teenager to try pot and, you know, listen to Pink Floyd and that kind of thing. But I didn't really start drinking steadily until I was about 21. And I started off with kind of girly drinks with umbrellas in them. And I ended up very soon after that just drinking straight scotch and that kind of thing. And it escalated quite quickly. And I quit drinking when I was 26 after that. But it was a steady decline. And I knew that I lost choice.
Yes, that's right.
I lost choice in, I'm going to go out tonight and have one drink. I wasn't, you know, I didn't drink during the day and I didn't do that. But when I started drinking, I could never predict with any kind of accuracy how many I would have or what would happen when I did. And that, you know, started the adventure of blackouts and craziness and all of that stuff. Because at that point, once I made the decision to put alcohol into my body, I then forfeited my right of choice of what happened. And I knew it about 4 years in. I knew I don't have a choice in this. I have to do this. If I start drinking, I don't have a choice in what happens. And toward the end, that was basically what got me into, you know, I had, you know, the usual things, car crashes and bad relationships and falling down and stupid things. And, you know, being an intelligent person and watching your idiotic behavior and going, this is incongruent.
Yes.
You know, it's really, and that's what I felt. There was a big space between what I thought I was and was capable of at some point and what I was actually doing.
Yeah.
I also felt it was almost like cold breath on the back of my neck going, if this does not stop, I will die an ugly, self-inflicted alcoholic death and soon.
Yeah.
And that's what got me in.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's when I said, that's it. I cannot do this anymore. And I didn't after that.
You sought help from
Yes, I did. I had, you know, it's like self-help programs there.
Yeah,
and since then, I haven't.
Was that in Miami?
That was in Miami.
Yeah.
Sober in Miami.
Yeah.
Good place to get sober.
Yes.
It's the last place in the United States you can make a geographical tour without falling off the continent, you know. Okay. And so there's lots of drunks down there and there's lots of really strong sobriety as a result of that.
Yeah. That's right. Well, look, I feel I'd like to play your first selection of music. Do you want to say a few words? It's a very popular song, probably one of the most popular songs of all time. It's Jerry Rafferty with Baker Street.
Right.
What made you choose this?
That, to me, Baker Street, it hits me in my heart, in my heart chakra, if you want to think of that, because it's almost his inner struggling with trying to define his life and trying to find a way and what's the right thing and, you know, being, and it's a struggle out from here. And I empathize a lot with that. And it's not just on, you know, living in London is no good and, you know, which it goes into the sinks, but it is this thing where he's struggling with himself to come to some kind of, connection with what he wants, what he says he wants and what he wants, you know, and what what can happen from here. And besides that, it is just a phenomenal piece of music.
It really is.
It's just just makes me every time I hear it at the saxophone things, I get up and I dance. Thank you very much.
Okay, well here comes Jerry Rafferty with Baker Street.
Thank you.
Wow, what a track. Iconic, isn't it? Yeah.
Very much so.
The wonderful sax solo, and also the guitar solo as well. And just the whole thing, you know. And right, okay then. So there was quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, wasn't there? You got married.
Yeah.
You got sober in America, but you came over here and you came back.
Yeah.
Then you came back again.
Yes.
To UK.
Yeah.
And by this time you have...
I have three children.
Three children.
Yeah. We started in Miami and we came to England, but we ended up also came back to Tucson, Arizona, where we worked in treatment centers there.
Yeah.
And I've been teaching. I started teaching yoga in Miami in 1982.
Yeah.
1982, and have been ever since, which I find really conducive with recovery, not just for relaxation, but for self-awareness and self, that kind of thing. And in the meantime, we had three children, one of them born in England. So, so yeah, there was a lot of that going on, but all kind of centered around recovery, you know, kind of self-empowerment, you know, all of that kind of thing, especially during the 80s and the 90s. That was like gigantic. And as a result of that, you know, but we did get eventually a divorce, which was that was fine. And we came back to England because we wanted our children to be able to go to schools here in university. They all graduated from university here. So and as a result of that, continuing on my sobriety, really working in in with the yoga and various other things. It's like, a you know, worked all over England. Presenting at yoga festivals, that kind of stuff. So
do you get over the years, do you get much time to go back and see your family?
We go sometimes, you know, I go sometimes. It's like my son is next week or so moving back to Austin, Texas, to Music City. Which is really exciting. And we go, I go back and forth, you know, for various different things. Weddings, or, you know, that kind of thing. But visiting, I like to visit Miami. I like to go where I got sober, where there are people who have known me all this time since 1979 that are still there, and they are my it's where I germinated from. That's where I germinated from, and they're still there. And I guess it's that salmon fly, you know, swimming back upstream to go back home.
Of course.
I need to do that, but I do. You know, I travel back and forth to the United States, but this is now home, and it has been home for 20 years. So I'm well connected into the recovery community here.
I know you are, of course,
and have been for many years.
Do you know? Do you know of a place called the Triangle Club in Miami?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I because when I was awarded the Winston Churchill Travel Fellowship, 2011, and I was only in Miami for a couple of days, but I went to this Triangle Club.
Yes.
And I was made very welcome.
Very welcome. Yeah, they are. And they're a happy bunch of people in recovery. They're happy to be recovery, and it was like we had talked previously. Miami is the last place in America you can go besides Key West, without falling to make your geographical cure. And so, where are you going to go? You're not going to go to Iowa and or you know to someplace cold. You're going to go to someplace warm, tropical.
Exactly. Yeah,
and it's the last place you can go before you fall off the United States. So there's a lot of like big drunks going down there, but there are also a lot of people getting sober there, recovery.
In fact, my first guest, Steve, you know Steve, Steve Dan, and he actually has connections with that Triangle Club in Miami, Florida.
Lots of great places there.
That's right.
I got sober in the Coral Room. If anybody goes there, go to the Coral Room.
No, that's great. So, but as you rightly said, you've become integrated now, and you're at home in London.
Yeah.
And, right. I'm interested also in what's gone on in the last several 10 years. Have you always had an interest? Because I know you make films now, or you're involved in filmmaking,
screenwriting, and filmmaking.
Screenwriting, and have you always had an interest in films?
Well, I've always liked films. I'm kind of like collect information about films. And there's been this little sneaking voice in the back of my head for the last quite a long time, 20 years ago. You know, this is, and I think everybody has an idea for a screenplay out from here. But I was like, well, I have this story I like, and I did a little writing here and there, and I just decided, you know, it's like, well, you know, I was like, well on here, not a kid by any stretch of the imagination. You know, my children are all grown and all of that, and I was like, well, you know, how do you do that? You know, it's like, it's like, well, you know, and the voice in my head said, well, you know, people learn how to do things. Oh, they really? How to do that? Well, you know, they can read books. It's like, you don't know how to write screenplays. So I went to the library and I got Screenwriting for Dummies. And I'll tell you what, even now, when I still go back to that book because it is really, you do this, and this. Yeah. This is why you do this, and this. Read a lot of screenplays and all that stuff. And my first screenplay, and I've written five now that have all won, you know, surprisingly, lots of awards and all that stuff. My the first one I ever wrote came in top 10 in Francis Ford Coppola's American Zoetrope. Out of like 5,000 scripts, came in top 10. He picked mine out, going, "Yeah, this is good." So, you know, I'm almost like, "Well, you know, these things can be learned. These things can be things." It's like if you got that little thing in the back of your head that's poking you in the back of the head, that's it's really important to, because I would have really been upset, disappointed in myself had I not gotten Screenwriting for Dummies. And as a result of that, we've made a couple of short films. As a result of that, I'm getting ready to film another one. So, and it's all, you know, well after 50 kind of a thing, you know, and come in and, you know, kind of beating out the kids.
That's great.
It is. It is great. You know, and I think anybody, like a friend of mine went from from being in business for life, she's younger than I am, being in business and making lots of money from that. And she decided she wanted to be an opera singer, and that's what she did. She now sings with the English National Opera.
Really?
You know, and it's sort of like, you need to do that.
That's it.
You need to do that. And I think your sobriety gives you the opens a way for you to be able to do those kinds of things.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
I'd like to explore that more. But before we do, can we play your second choice of music, which is it resonates with me very deeply and fondly, because I love this track. Say a bit about her.
Well, this is Buffalo Springfield, and this was the protest song of the 60s, of which now completely resonates with what's going on now. If you listen to the lyrics, it's exactly, it's the young people carrying signs, you know, it's young people out there in the streets, you know, it's all of that kind of thing. And that's exactly, I mean, I have pictures of the last protests out here, and I have a picture of a woman from 1960s when she was protesting about the Vietnam War and all of that stuff and the civil rights and all of that. And she's like, I can't believe I'm out here again doing same sign, you know. And so I think it's really important. And this really does resonate with me. It resonated with me then, and then I started listening to it again. And I was like, this is now. Again.
Still,
you know, so,
And still is, it's...
For what it's worth,
From what it's worth, Buffalo Springfield, who comprised of, I think it's Stephen Stills, Neil Young. They were the two
main ones.
And it's just a great sound. It's more than a great sound. There's a kind of atmosphere about
this. Yes, it is. It's kind of, I don't know, holy almost.
Here it comes anyway, for what it's worth, Buffalo Springfield.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines
one's being wrong. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop.
Wow, that was the Buffalo Springfields. And, well, Buffalo Springfield, isn't it? Anyway, yeah. It was the Buffalo Springfield. And I know Neil Young and Stephen Stills. Who else was in it? I can't think at the moment. Mm. But I'm sure your listeners, you'll know out there. Mm. But we were just talking about that sound. It's so powerful. And,
yes,
and as you say, so relevant today, mm-hmm. The lyrics march. Mm-hmm. And things are kind of similar to the 60s, although, well, in the protest world, there's lots of people, you know,
carrying signs,
yeah. Yeah, even children.
Little children
with climate change. And
isn't it climate change, you know, the President of the United States.
Yeah,
You know, I was at one of the protests. I was saying to you earlier, it was like, this is my new hobby.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
out there. You know, I could think up a jazzy sign to carry out there and, you know, yeah. confound people and, you know, without being, you know, calling out anybody like, oh, you're ugly or something like that, but,
yeah.
you know, to their policies. But I found a very, very, you know, this was, I think, the Trump protest about a year ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she had a very expensive pram with a very expensive child in it, and she was dressed very expensively. Mm. She was very British, and she had a sign that said, actually, I'm really quite cross about all of this.
Really?
I thought, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Very British. But so that's my new things. I was saying earlier that I complain on Facebook like everybody does. But I also, because I have a member of parliament and I have a U.S. senator from which to, I send the things that I believe and I think are wrong and I think need to be changed. Mm. I send them emails. I've called up and left things on their voicemails.
Yeah.
I've actually sent an actual letter to the White House. I have sent things to my MP here, and we have a little email account. I think that's important. If you believe in something,
it is,
that's what they need to hear from constituents.
Sure.
They need to hear from that. And it's good to share it on Facebook, but it's a lot better to share it on their website.
Yeah,
you know, saying, because again, back in the 60s, we were saying, you know, the same people from the 60s are carrying the same signs in the same kind of protests about climate change, about how people are treated. Political just deviancies and that kind of thing that we're going in. And it has come full circle. All the same people that we protest against are still there in some way, shape, or form, you know, next generation down, but they're all still there. And it has made itself evident to what is going on right now.
Yeah.
And it is. It's like, you know, I get to vote. You get to vote.
Yeah.
I get to vote in both elections. So I'm like.
Yeah. Oh, you do. Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I have the British protest signs and I have the American protest signs. And I have my. So again, that's my new hobby. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Mm. I'd like to, you know, explore a little before the Buffalo Springfields were played. You were talking about, you know, screenwriting.
Yes.
And, but it was bigger than that, wasn't it, really?
Yes.
It was about, you know, kind of looking into your potential as a human being from recovery. That's
yes.
It. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, so I think we do tend to down, you know, it's not just people in recovery. It's, I think anybody who's born on earth is in some sort of recovery.
Yeah. Oh,
sort of
I
like,
believe
how
that
do we,
as well.
How do we do this?
Yeah.
I'm
definitely.
Not sure,
definitely.
You know,
yeah.
And
yeah.
a lot of people do not, you know, they go, oh, well, I'd like to do that. And in some way, shape or form, I think you can do most anything that you decide to. And it's like, well, I don't know how to. I'm telling you, YouTube is the best. You know, college you will ever go to.
Sure.
You can show you how to do anything.
Yeah, it will.
Anything.
Yeah.
You
That's
can,
right.
you know, again, that screenwriting, obviously, I've gotten other screenwriting books, but I've only had a couple of seminars I've gone to. And I've made it up through the best contests and been finalists and top tens and, you know, won a few from here.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have known that I could do that unless I just kind of went, well, how do you start? Get a book on it.
Yeah.
Look at a YouTube.
That's it.
You know, thing. Find out. Sometimes when you go after something, you find out you don't actually like it.
Yeah, exactly. And you can eliminate that and
well, that's done.
Move on.
You know, cross
but
that
YouTube,
off the...
you mentioned YouTube. I mean,
yeah.
I grew up, well, in the 60s as a teenager.
Yeah.
And I started playing guitar when I was 15. And in those days, I mean, it was... I knew someone in the area, so I kind of went round his house and learned some stuff on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But apart from that, the only real way, there was one guitar tutorial out, and that was Bert Weedon playing a day, you know. And, you know, I had to, you go to little clubs in London, and I would actually go up and look at people like Bert Jansch, John Remble, Al Stewart play, all the Paul Simon, who I used to see in London a lot in this little club, and remember... his kind of cording, the fretting.
Yeah.
And I go back and think, he played C and he played four. But I still learn.
Yeah.
But
well, that's why I spent my life in the library as a child.
Yeah.
It's like I wore out my library cards.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to learn things and read things and know those things. And we didn't really have access to that in my house. It was like I was the first one to ever go to college in my family.
Yeah.
But it came from, I read and read and read and read and read, and I looked into the how-to books there. The library was basically YouTube.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
That's where you found out your information.
Our YouTube,
You know, how do you do something? I don't know. Go look in the how-to section over there, you know. And look it up in the Dewey Decimal System.
And the thing is, in those days, this thing, somebody said, well, he's got a degree. You didn't dare speak to anyone who had a degree.
Yeah.
I heard a funny thing once, this priest actually, he said, but remember, he said, I'm not anti-intellectual. He said, I've got 3 degrees. He said, but thermometers have degrees. And you know where they put some thermometers, which kind of, it's a kind of thing, come on, you know, we can all learn.
Yeah.
But I grew up in a culture, in Croydon actually, where... there was a kind of anti-learning culture, really, at a lot of schools.
That's interesting, because where I grew up, on my street, there weren't many things. But the next street up, where a lot of my friends were, they were quite wealthy.
Mm.
They all went to college, you know, kind of thing. Now, and then I had a group on the other side of the street, literally on the other side of the track, where everybody just worked in a mill and that's all you ever wanted to do. It was kind of it was like, you know, I think I like the one that are reading books and going to school. I think I like that better. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but if you wanted to, it's all there. And Harris Library, where, you know, it's where actually Abraham Lincoln once did an address, was beyond that. And if you wanted to stay in the, well, you know, the mills all moved, but if you wanted to stay in that kind of thing, that's fine. But I was not like that.
No.
I was not. And something in me pushed.
Yeah.
And I went a little bit further than some people had. I didn't have the advantage of parents sending me to school. I just went by myself, you know.
No, that's right.
You know, so
yeah, in a sense, I identify with that. Although my dad was a prolific reader, but I wasn't kind of ready for that then. But when I was kind of guided to people, different people who kind of opened the doors to different worlds, really.
Look,
people that had travelled. And musically, you know, I was, when I was quite young, I was listening to Segovia, South American guitarist, rather than just the, you know, the rock stuff that was around, and which was all good, but it was quite a kind of interesting.
There's so much in the world that's out there, you know. Even now, it's like I'm going to need to lift on about 250 to even kind of scratch the surface to know what's there.
That's right.
And that's something that I'm always, you know, what does this word mean? Like, I found out what the Ides of March mean yesterday.
Ides
means the 13th to the 15th of the month. That's right, so I was like, ha! There was about three of us looked it up at the same time. I was like, oh, that's what that means. It's like you hear it all your life, but...
You do. That reminds me of the Ides of Mad with Alfred E. Newman's face on this little paperback.
Still with us, Alfred E.
He's still... Wow, I used to love Mad magazine.
You can still get it.
Can you still get
it?
Yes. Wow.
I'll find one for you.
I never forget there was a Mad magazine and it said, in this edition... We tell you the advantage of home movies. And they had conventional photo of the Newman family, which in itself was hilarious because there was a whole family. Yeah. They all had Alfred E. Newman's face.
Yeah.
And then it said, with home movie, with cine. And they were just waving their hands. And that was little hand movements with the Newman family.
Yeah.
But they were mad,
Yep. Mad Magazine, that was part of my education, Mad Magazine.
But no, it is fascinating what we, the potential in everyone, not as you say,
exactly.
Not
I think that's people. What recovery is about. Well, it is about recovering, obviously, from the horrible effects of drugs, alcohol, and other things, but it's also recovering your humanity. You are supposed to be a real, live, functioning burgeoning human being.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, of course.
That's the point.
That's the point of it. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Fully, I remember reading, I read lots of those self-help inspirational books in the early years. Fully Human, Fully Alive, one of them was called. And that never stops, does it?
No. No, it doesn't start. I think it accelerates. In my case,
it does.
Once
with me,
I was back, I had quite a few years of sobriety, and the kids grew up. It was a really strong urge, and it does accelerate you're alive. And I think that's what a lot of the things that recovery gives you. It gives you the platform to be a human being, to display your humanity, to explore all of that stuff. And not just explore, but to demonstrate it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you're a fantastic musician, you know, and that would all have been lost.
Yes, that's right. What amazes me, Marge, because like you, I do a lot of different things, but I do a lot of presentations, about my life in various places. And every time I start one, I get a bit of apprehension, but I remember in early recovery, I couldn't dream of doing anything like that. Standing in front of a room full of people and sharing, I just couldn't dream of doing that. But we could. It's within all of us, isn't it? Whatever path we want to take.
Yeah. Well, that's again, the path you want to take is starting, doing some research, and finding out what exactly it takes to do that. And, I remember one guy in recovery, which was quite inspirational. He was, I think, about 45 or 48 at the time.
Yeah.
Got sober, got class, and he decided that as a kid, he always wanted to be an airline pilot.
Yeah.
And somebody says, you are too old, man.
Yeah.
And so he started off, the little putt-putt planes, you know, to learn into little things, you know, tiny plane out from there. And then from that, he graduated to a single engine, you know, Comanches and that kind of thing. And then he went on to, he then put prop jets, and then he learned from that, he learned jets, and now he flies for EasyJet.
I think I might know who that is. Yeah, that's it.
Not that I don't know about EasyJet, such a hot place to work, but he's there in a cockpit, in a jetliner, flying it.
That's
when
it.
Somebody said, you're too old to do that.
That's it, you know. No, it's funny, you know, when people, if you like, new to recovery, you know, I'm talking with them and they say, well, I don't know what to do. And I said, I know, I said, isn't it fantastic? They said, no, I need to know. It's one of the seven deadly needs, you really need to know. Yeah. And the thing is, with me, it's good sometimes not to know.
Yeah.
And as life unfolds, you know, you take up a suggestion or somebody says something and you try something and, hey, next, and you, I mean, about 4 years ago, a little mini career opened up for me as a voiceover artist. And I've always been interested in the voice. And 20 years ago, when my marriage finished, I got out of social work and I did a few things that I always wanted to do.
Yeah.
One of them was a radio presenter's course 20 years ago, the Bruno Brooks School of Radio. I got 2 weeks course and I got a 2-day voice workshop. Now, I'm using both of those now.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't, I had no idea I would be doing
this. Of course not.
And it's just wonderful how things kind of come to fruition, and it's like your screenwriting.
Who knew, right? Like, here's a trophy. Thanks.
That's amazing. Yeah, and when I read what's happening to you on Facebook, I think, wow, she's got this, or you've been submitted, some of your work's been submitted.
Yeah.
And that in itself is, isn't it?
I've got, you know, I've won, I think, maybe 25 contests, 25 already, you know. We've won... finalists, I mean, I have a page and a half of things that I've got, semifinals, finals, and or I have won. And that's with film, with screenplays, and different kinds, short, long features, that kind of thing. Now, you know, and God bless them, but I never went to film school.
No.
But I'm up in the, I'm playing with the big boys up there who have been to film school and have been to screenwriting and have mastered. I know one guy's master's degree, and, but not that that's a bad thing.
No,
I beat him.
Hey, that's fantastic.
Yeah,
that's fantastic. Yeah. We're kind of similar stages, aren't we? In recovery. Yeah. You've been, you were telling me I didn't. You, a long time for
39 years.
Because in recovery, you know, some.
Because I came in when I was 4. I stopped drinking when I was 4 years old.
Yeah, that's.
I was a nightmare at the nursery. It was horrible.
Anyway, look, it's been great, Marge, spending time with you, and I'm sure our listeners will enjoy this.
Hope so.
And let's close, let's play out with your third piece of music. And this is it's by Vaughan Williams, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you want to introduce it?
Well, it's The Lark Ascending, and you know, it is a popular classical piece, but the reason I like it is because it does that lark ascending. It speaks to your soul of you're more than just your physical parameters. You are more than that. There's something that lifts, that goes, that's part of. And I know it sounds very esoteric, but part of a larger whole, connected in ways and rising. And again, I think that's why put the lark ascending. And going up and joining with all of that.
Sure.
So I think it's, I whenever I hear this piece of music, I always stop and listen to it. It feeds my soul somehow.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we're going to stop there. I just thank you once again, Margie.
Oh, and, you're welcome.
Here's The Lark Ascending. Thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.